Hi, this is John Udall, and in today's podcast, I interview Phil Libben, president of CoreStreet, a company whose innovative approach to large-scale, decentralized credential validation I first wrote about in InfoWorld a couple of years ago. We began with a discussion of FIPS 201, a program of the U.S. government that was kicked off by an August 2004 presidential directive, and that lays out a broad mandate for unified identity infrastructure, covering both physical and virtual security, that will be used by all federal agencies and departments.
So let's rewind and kind of go through what this FIPS 201 deal is. I've got a few background things here that have told me that it's, according to one estimate, going to take perhaps as long as until 2009 for all of the 4 million common access cards to be revved to the new standard. But I guess, on the other hand, a lot of it's already done, and most of it will be done pretty soon. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, there's FIPS 201 stuff in general, and then there's the, how does it relate to the DoD?
Right.
So the DoD has the CAC, the Common Access Card,
yes,
which they've had for years now before FIPS 201. And so they feel that, they've already decided a lot of these questions and solved a lot of these issues, and, they've issued 4 million cards and, their CAC cards. And so there's a big movement there to say, well, we are, CAC is sort of the precursor to FIPS 201, and we're not going to go and, retrofit things just because there's a new standard now. So that's being decided exactly. How compatible is CAC with FIPS 201? Does it mean that?
Oh, so it's not clear whether or not they'll be able to declare victory and say that they've already got it, or whether they'll have
right.
to make some changes.
That's right. And there's also several timelines for FIPS. Basically agencies have until I think maybe October 27th of this year.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong on the exact date, but it's basically sometime in October is when they have to have basically be compliant with PIV 1.
With say what?
PIV 1. So it's a PIV is a personal identity verification.
Okay.
So the first stage, which happens in October, is basically all the agencies have to self-certify that they've got a plan to be in full compliance with FIPS 201 and that they're going through the following procedures for basically background checks and authentication of people that they're issuing credentials for. So
okay.
Any agency that's credentialing their own people has to say, these are the guidelines that we've embraced and we're following them, and they're sort of spiritually compatible with FIPS 201, and we have a plan to be fully FIPS 201 compatible.
So that's kind of the background due diligence.
Yeah.
But then there's also this, you guys referred me to this, 87-page PDF, which is the one with all the specs on the cards themselves and the photographs of how the cards lay out and what's on the...
There's three documents, right, that talk about all that stuff. Right?
Okay.
The actual FIPS 201 is the name of a document.
Okay.
And then there's two... The FIPS 201 document refers to kind of two even more specialized documents. That one is like the 800-73, which talks about the details of the actual, certificates. And one is the 800-76, which talks about mostly biometric stuff.
Okay, so 201 is, in fact, the name of the publication.
Yeah.
It's not the name of a standard.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, so the first phase, PIV 1, is basically all the federal agencies saying, we have a plan, and we are going to be in compliance with this. And so the DoD is going to be, PIV 1 compliant on October 27th.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to say, we have a plan for doing this, and here's where it is.
Of this year?
Of this year, that's
okay.
Right. And then agencies have until October of next year, so they basically have an extra 12 months to actually make sure that all of their cards really are, PKI-based, and the certificates are all issued in the same way, and, the standards are compatible and interoperable. So they basically have 12 months and then implement all this stuff. And so that's still, for the DoD, a little bit of an open question, where are they going to be able to say that, the existing CAC cards, meet PIV 2 standard, or are they going to have to make some kind of modifications, or
mm-hmm.
are they going to get some kind of special exemption? That's all still up in the air.
So outside of the DoD, what is the scope of this?
Well, it's all federal agencies.
Yeah, but in other words, all you hear about is the DoD's 4 million cards. You don't hear a whole lot about who else has them in the government.
Oh, that's really getting underway. So the Department of Homeland Security has several, major efforts going on. They're going to be FIPS 201 kind of from the beginning.
Okay.
So they're issuing, you remember, remember the TWIC program?
No.
Transportation Workers Identity Credential?
No.
So that's just one example. There's a TWIC program, was a card program that the Department of Homeland Security announced pretty much quickly after being formed. They were going to issue cards to like 20 million transportation workers. And so like that's an example of something that's, you know, would get rolled up into FIPS 201.
Okay.
They're also issuing cards to all of their employees. They've actually started that. There's the DAC, the basically Department of Homeland Security Access Control Card is a program that they're starting to issue. And pretty much all the other agencies as well, you know, Department of Interior, you know, Treasury, Justice, all
okay.
of those guys,
okay.
you know, by October will say, here's our plan to issue these cards, and then 12 months after that, we'll actually have to have cards issued.
Okay. So then I quizzed Mr. Nolte a little bit about what the applications are,
mm-hmm.
whether they're doing digital signatures, whether they're using these things to authenticate to services online, whether they're using them for physical security. And it sounds like it's all very basic at this point, that
mm-hmm.
there's some digital signature happening, but that after early high expectations, they ratcheted back when they kind of caught up with the reality of that. And so now you don't have to sign every email, including the one that asks someone else to lunch. You only have to sign the ones that, you know, I guess some best practices document recommends that you do. And there's some amount of authentication to online services, websites, and so on. And I guess at least in his area, little physical security happening.
Right. Yeah, the approach that I think FIPS 201 has taken is really one of an infrastructure.
Uh-huh.
The idea is they're going to put this infrastructure in place where everyone is going to have cards that interoperate, and there's going to be this known set of standards for, you know, how you go about digitally signing something, or in fact verifying that signature is valid, and how you go about authenticating someone. So it's really, you know, like a electric grid. You know, they're really just laying out the very basic infrastructure of this, and then applications that sit on top of that, you know, whether it's digitally signed email or, you know, electronic forms or physical security, you know, those are more like you know, like appliances that you'll wind up plugging into your electric grid at some point. And so they're doing less specification on the applications that you have to use. Those are really much more open to the, you know, each individual department or agency. What the FIPS 01 is saying overall, right, this actually started with, to be technically accurate about it, with Homeland Security Presidential Directive 12,
yeah.
which is sort of the precursor to FIPS 01, is saying that the heads of all federal agencies have to make sure that all of their employees are under a common credential program for access to all physical and IT resources.
Yeah.
So the high-level direction is, you know, you get the infrastructure in place for everyone, and then use your best practices to make sure that all physical and IT resources are protected using these cards. But the, you know, how to actually do that, what the actual applications are, there's a lot more discretion there, and that's
yeah.
still being ironed out.
And there's also a bunch of mechanisms in play. I mean, it seems that the photograph is required. There's obviously what's on the circuit. There's let's see, what else? Well, actually, the signature is optional. The PDF data is optional.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it really is just, maybe there's not, I was thinking there's kind of multiple modes here, but really not that much that is mandatory. There's a
yeah.
mag stripe, I guess, which is, it says optional also.
Yeah, on the applications, there's a lot, there's few things on the application side that are fully mandated right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to get, you know, get the infrastructure, get the cards done, and then, you know, you don't want to necessarily force people to use particular applications. You want to, once you have the infrastructure, show what kinds of applications are possible, and then, you know, the best practices will emerge from that, and then the mandates will emerge from the best practices.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Things like, you know, digital signed email is going to be, I believe, you know, fully required for every single piece of email. It's just that's not going to be the case in the next 6 months, but
mm-hmm.
2 years from now, I'm very confident that there will not be an email sent out by anyone legitimate in the government that's not digitally signed.
Hmm.
And when you think about it, there really shouldn't be, because all of these issues of, you know, phishing and spam and stuff like that, you know, the only way that you can meaningfully solve them is to just actually know who's sending each email.
Yes. No, I've been an advocate of that for a long time, although I have to say lately I've been less vigilant about it since being seduced by Gmail, which doesn't support signatures.
Yeah,
it's the first email application I've used in almost a decade that doesn't support that. And since actually, essentially, no one with whom I have ever communicated ever gave a damn that I signed my emails, it's been kind of seductive to let it fall by the wayside for the time being.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that Gmail is seductive. I hear you. Basically, the only reason that I kind of prevent myself from using it is because I do have to sign all my mail. So.
Yes.
That's about it. But, you know, Google will get that right sooner or later.
Uh-huh. So where do you guys sit in the scheme? It's pretty much the story that it was, which is that you're part of the validation infrastructure, right?
Well, I mean, that's our core technology. That's our core infrastructure product is the validation infrastructure for that. And we're now being used by the DoD, by DHS, by a couple of other agencies, by international governments that are emulating some of these processes. And then we also work pretty closely with partners to come up with the applications that will actually plug into this infrastructure.
Right. One of the things I thought that was interesting when we first talked about your stuff was that at least at the time, you were pointing out that you were able to use a non-secured content distribution network like Akamai to push these credentials out to the edge or out to the sort of, what would you call them, the edge responders.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it's kind of morphed a little bit since then, right? In terms of what they've actually implemented?
No, that's still the architecture.
Okay.
They have set up, well, I guess it depends on who they are. There's multiple implementations here. But the DoD in the current rollout, is setting up a series of, responder nodes with unsecured responders, with these, keyless responders.
Yeah, but on their network, right?
Well, the first few nodes are being deployed by General Dynamics.
Okay.
And then, they still haven't fully decided what all the nodes are. But they are, for example, buying our, responder appliances. So these are the little 1U pieces of hardware that just goes into your, local wiring closet.
Yes.
And so that's, even closer to the edge than Akamai would be.
Yes.
So that whole architecture, basically distributing the validation proofs as close as possible to the actual user, into unsecure distributed locations is very much what they're doing right now.
Yes.
So, yeah, and outside the DoD, in the DHS and others, the deployment architecture is still wide open. In fact, we are working with Akamai and with CyberTrust and with other companies to propose different deployment architectures.
Right.
I actually still think that doing this with Akamai makes a lot of sense.
And you're doing that in other situations?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, so talk about that a little bit. I mean, we should just, in other words, review what we've discussed before about the notion that the proofs themselves are integrity protected and therefore can flow around on the network without worries because it's the CA, right? That's really the secured entity.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the basic idea was that, the internet, sort of likes to operate in a certain mode and hates operating in different modes. And, the internet is in general, is really good at being widely distributed. So you can get a piece of information on the internet very, very efficiently as long as you're not actually making a demand that you communicate with a particular server right now and you have guarantees that no one can be listening in at that time and that, no one could have infiltrated that and that everything is secure. When you have that sort of a, more of a point-to-point connected architecture, the internet is just not very good at that, not very scalable. It loses a lot of its efficiencies.
Yep.
And that was the model that, that people were doing or PKI validation in. So every time you wanted to do a transaction, you had to connect to some vault, and basically find out whether or not the certificate that you'd gotten was revoked or not. And of course that had all the same centrally connected problems that the whole internet was designed to avoid in the first place. And the DoD, of course, understands this because, they were the first ones that came up with, the ARPANET, the thing that was the internet before it was the internet, and the whole point of that was to have a widely distributed system that could survive a, massive attack or something like this. So they've understood this concept of you really can't have, centralized secure resources that play a role in every transaction because it just won't scale and it won't be secure and it'll be too expensive.
So just run through the details real quickly of how and why it is that the proofs as they sit in Akamai's edge servers are usable for the intended purpose but safe from interlopers.
Oh, well, the we have our validation authority, which is a basically an offline system that does sit in a secure facility. And that authority goes through every single person or every single certificate that it knows about under management, and it pre-computes all of the possible proofs, all of the possible answers to all of the possible questions that someone might ask about each of these people, and it pre-computes them in advance at regular time intervals, you know, every hour or every day or however often you want to do this. And of course, doing that, you know, efficiently and quickly for tens of millions of certificates is part of what we do.
Right.
And pre-computes them, and then once it computes them, it digitally signs them with its own private keys, which are offline, just like CA keys are offline. And then once those proofs are pre-computed and pre-signed, they can be sent out, you know, anywhere. So they've got each proof has a time interval attached to it, so you know that it's the proof for, you know, this particular day or this particular hour or whoever, whatever you want your granularity to be. And once you have that, they can be sent out to, you know, any responders, any cache, appliances or machines, and whatever you want to know whether a certificate is valid and what privileges are associated with a certificate. It's just a question of going out to your closest distributed cache and getting that proof and checking the digital signature to know that it hasn't been tampered with and checking the time interval to know that it's still valid for today or for whatever your time interval is.
And does it need to be encrypted to the endpoint application, or is the information just of no value unless you are the endpoint application?
It usually does not need to be encrypted because, yeah, the application is of no value unless the endpoint application has actually physically got the certificate to match it up against.
Uh-huh.
It could be encrypted if you wanted to.
Yep, but doesn't need to be. Generally.
Doesn't need to be. There's some you know, specialty applications where some customers may choose to encrypt them, but the vast majority of the time, even in like DoD stuff, it doesn't need to be.
Right. Now, an aspect that isn't really central to what Mr. Nolte does, but is obviously very central to what the military as a whole does, is field operations in situations of low bandwidth, intermittent connectivity, and all of those kinds of conditions that make online real-time stuff difficult to impossible. So I asked him that question. He said, yeah, they, Core Street, have got all kinds of stuff that they're marketing really heavily to us. It's not really relevant in my world, but I think that there's more stuff happening along those lines in Homeland Security. So, that'd be an interesting, if we can talk about it, be an interesting thing to hear a little bit more about.
Yeah, we've actually got a couple of new products since you were here last. In fact, we should set up some time for you to come by and take a look at them. We have one family of products which is pretty interesting in that area. Basically, we target it at first responders, and the idea is if there's a natural disaster or an attack or some kind of an emergency, people will set up a perimeter around wherever the attack or disaster emergency happened, and then lots of first responders show up. And first responders can be members of many different types of organizations. You know, they could be, if this happens in D.C., you could have Fairfax County firefighters and Maryland sheriff's deputies and Coast Guard and Department of Homeland Security people and DoD people. You can have dozens of different agencies which have credentialed first responders. And so they show up, and it's a very difficult problem to actually know how do you efficiently check to make sure that people that you're admitting sort of into the perimeter are actually supposed to be there, especially since chances are your networks are down, the cell network may be down or unreliable, it's an emergency condition. So what we've got is rugged handheld computers, basically a ruggedized Windows CE device. That we call the PIVMAN, Personal Identity Verification Management System.
Yeah.
And it can read any different type of credential. So it's got a contact smart card reader, a 2D barcode reader. We're just about to add a contactless reader, so it can read contactless cards and proximity cards and that kind of stuff.
Huh.
And it knows how to read multiple types of cards. And it knows the validity status of any person that might come up to it. It knows the validity status for tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people, and it does that without having to make any network connection at the time of transaction.
So this is the flooding idea that we talked about before?
Yeah, this is actually the, if you remember the validation heartbeat idea.
Yes.
That we talked about, this is the first product that actually uses that technology, where it takes millions, or actually already tens of millions, of people, and it takes their privilege lists, which it imports from many discrete sources. So different agencies just publish their own privilege lists, and the agencies don't have to cooperate with each other, they don't have to share information, they don't have to put things in the same format.
But they all have to be keyed to the same set of identities, right?
They all have to be keyed to their set of identities.
Yeah.
So like the Fairfax County, you know, volunteer fire department says, you know, these are the 100 people that we have, and, you know, when you read a card, here's how you know if it's one of ours. And, you know, here are the ones that are credentialed for, you know, hazardous material, first responder, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And all those databases are converted into these, you know, what we have been calling mini CRLs or validation heartbeats, so these really tiny files where it's only about 1 bit per person.
One bit per person for the identity itself, and then presumably additional bits for privileges, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
It was basically 1 bit per person per privilege. So
okay.
A little bit less than that because there's some pretty efficient compression, but that's a good sort of outer bound on it.
And what scale do you have to get up to for that equation to hold?
The overhead is hundreds of bytes. You know, so it starts holding at thousands.
Oh, okay.
You know, you don't need to be at millions for it to make sense, but obviously when you're at millions then all the overhead just washes out into nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we make this master file of basically every qualified valid first responder, and that file is then basically being constantly transmitted and updated to these handhelds. And so, if the network is up, then you know they actually have GPRS in them, and they can just get it periodically via GPRS. Or they also have Ethernet cradles. So if it's just sitting in the cradle, it just gets it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, opportunistically, whenever it senses the network is up, it gets the full list, and then when it's actually time to validate someone, it reads a card, it authenticates it. If it's a smart card with a PKI, then it authenticates it using, you know, real public-private key stuff. If it's just a 2D barcode, then, you know, all it can really do to authenticate is just to read it and to, you know, parse it in the way that it knows it's supposed to be written.
Is this enough data for it to need to stream into the device and for it to be able to, you know, stop and start, or does it really need to kind of get the whole chunk at this point?
No, it streams it in. It's all segmented.
Okay.
So it streams
it in. So
it
can get whatever it can get in its little window of connectivity, if that's the way things are.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And then it reads the card, it displays the authentication information on the screen, and then it also immediately displays, you know, the validation and the privilege information.
Yes.
And you know, it does all that without any kind of network connectivity. And so that's a pretty cool thing. It's a pretty dramatic way to just show, you know, any credential in an emergency situation.
So is this deployed physically at some point?
Going to do the first. We actually just received the payment for the first few batches that we sold into DHS, and be deploying them in over the next couple of months.
So they'll be sitting in what kinds of locations?
Initially, it'll be around DC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'll be first responder use for DC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it'll be in emergency vehicles, that kind of stuff.
And so it'll be access to vehicles, access to buildings, things like that.
Yeah, and just perimeters, like free floating perimeters.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
So if there's a gas main, you know, explosion somewhere, and they need to cordon off, you know, four square blocks, then kind of the people standing there at the perimeter will just have these units in their hands.
Okay, got it.
And we're also in discussion with sort of other areas in the DOD, like Gil mentioned, and, you know, a few foreign governments to do this for other applications.
And what do you call this?
It's called PIVMAN, P-I-V-M-A-N.
PIV Manager. Okay.
Yeah. The PIV manager.
Okay.
And I can send you some. We have I think we just put together the first data sheet on it, so it's got pictures of it and everything. I'll send you that. But it's neat. It's a neat looking demo. You know, it's working. It's kind of fun to play with because it's ruggedized. You can, you know, throw it at a wall and it doesn't theoretically break anything. So we've been having a good time with it, and obviously getting a very good reaction to it because it's just a dramatic demo.
Yeah. And so on the management side, if I'm this Fairfax County, you said what, the fire department or
sure,
whoever they are,
and I'm using that organization hypothetically.
Yeah, okay. So hypothetically, that organization, what's the process for merging whatever they have in their LDAP directory or whatever it be with this system?
Well, there's like three stakeholders in this. There's the what I'll call the main sponsoring organization, which let's say that's the Department of Homeland Security in this case, but it could be the DOD or, you know, anyone else. Mm-hmm. That's the organization that's actually deployed the Core Street, the server, the PIF server. It's basically mm-hmm. a VA validation authority with some additional technology into it. That's what's doing the offline proof signing.
Mm-hmm.
Then that organization is what basically delegates responsibility to other organizations to credential people. So DHS will say to, you know, the following police departments and fire departments and military people, okay, you know, you are responsible for credentialing, you know, your individual people.
Right.
So you couldn't just have some, you know, some random, you know, company start up and start, you know, credentialing people as first responders.
Right.
So the sponsoring organization actually has to, you know, buy Core Street server-side software and some professional services to get all that set up and running.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are the actual organizations that credential the employees. Those could be, you know, big or small organizations. They don't have to do anything other than tell us how they're going to export, you know, basically their privilege files.
Okay. So you're pretty much hosting the CA, and then they just dump records to you, and you do it for them as a service.
And if that organization is already, is for example, the simplest case, if that organization is already doing PKI stuff, which will be all the government ones after FIPS 201 happens,
yes.
Right, over the next 18 months, they'll be all PKI, then if they don't want to do privileges, they just want to do, you know, yes, this person is a credential member or not, then they don't have to do anything. We just pick up their CRL.
Right.
You know, and then they don't even have to know about it. We just pick up their CRL. That's published public information anyway, and then that works out. If they want to do, you know, CRL plus privileges, then they have to say, okay, we're going to use SAML for our privileges or something, and we'll say, okay, fine, you know, give us the LDAP address so that we can go and pull your privilege files out of or something like that. Or they can give us, you know, comma delimited ASCII files. You know, it doesn't really matter. So these organizations, all they do is they've got to report on who they've credentialed and who they haven't, which is really something that they're probably doing already, or at least should be doing already. So it's not a major, you know, it's not a major new thing for them.
Right.
And then the third party are the, you know, the actual people that are holding these units, you know, that are actually holding these first responder handhelds in their hands, and you know, they don't have to do anything. They just need to, you know, buy or somehow procure these, you know, these handheld devices.
Okay. Very cool. So this is kind of off topic, but since I've got you, I've been wanting to ask you about this anyway. I've been thinking again lately about this concept, which has been around for a long time, and it's sort of caught on in some places, but not really. The idea of the one-time credit card number,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, every time somebody steals another batch of 40 million credit cards,
yeah.
I always wonder, you know, why are we in this situation where we store people's, where we allow people to use these durable IDs, these credit card numbers, and
yep.
they get passed around, they sit in databases waiting to be broken into and compromised. So it's been a long time since there were various card issuers that had, at least for online purchasing, the service of, I'll set a limit on this purchase, you'll mm-hmm. generate me a number, it looks just like a Visa number, it works just like a Visa number.
Yep.
You know about it, right? So,
Absolutely.
It's had some uptake, I guess. There was the Amex Blue Card for a while. I know some people who use, I think, Citibank who have this service. But it really, first of all, hasn't caught on very big at all in the online
yeah.
world, and obviously isn't happening at all in the real world where people take plastic out of their wallets. And it just kind of occurred to me, well, it could, couldn't it? I mean, all these technologies could be kind of reconfigured to do something like that.
It could. In fact, in a couple of weeks, I should walk you through this. We've got a way that I think is going to make a very big impact on specifically this kind of identity theft. Can't talk about it quite this week, but very soon. I'd love to walk you through it and
okay.
get your thoughts on that. But you're right. Yeah, that's a clear application for it. Probably not strictly for FIPS 201 stuff because, you know, one of the things that we're trying to balance out, that the government's trying to balance out, is kind of the feature creep on FIPS 201. You know, what applications should people actually be using with it? You know, which applications may be good ideas, but have, you know, privacy concerns, you know, and so on. So people have discussed using FIPS cards for purchases. I don't know if that's such a good idea for that particular program, for the FIPS 201 program. It's certainly a good idea in general.
Yeah, in general is what I'm thinking. And then for it to work, you'd have to hit the sweet spot. You'd have to go to the mainstream, and that would mean, I guess, you know, writing to the mag stripe, not just, right, because that's what's really out there.
Yeah, I'll definitely give you a call in a couple of weeks, and we have a way worked out that I think you'll find interesting that should make a big impact on this kind of stuff.
Excellent.
You know, there's a deadline coming up on the 27th of August next month for you know, basically federal officials who are coming up with ideas for applications for using FIPS 201 compatible cards, compliant cards. And so there's going to be some interesting thought, I think, that comes out of that about what kinds of applications, you know, should we have for it. And, you know, you'll see the normal ones, you know, signed email and signed documents and physical security, which we're still very actively pursuing the physical security angle. I think we showed you the early prototypes of our locks and things, and those have been, you know, finalized and built, and we've got, you know, manufacturing relationships out now.
Who's the largest user of a door lock solution?
Excuse me?
Who's the largest customer right now of a door lock solution from you?
Well, we're just setting up the initial pilots.
Okay.
So we've got five companies here that are getting installed. I think we just installed the first one or two a couple weeks ago, and, you know, basically this is our summer of door lock pilots.
Okay.
But we've got, we have... down contracts with, I think when we talked, we had just started the work with Assa Abloy.
That's right.
Lock manufacturer, and we've actually extended that also to Honeywell, so now we're licensed. Honeywell has gotten a license from us for building this into all of their physical security management tools, and we're working with a couple of other companies in that space. And we should be doing physical lock installations at Department of Homeland Security over the next couple of months. We're still negotiating that with them. To really show the FIPS 201 card being used for kind of what Homeland Security Presidential Directive 12 intended, you know, access to both logical and physical data using the same PKI for both.
Yes.
You know, so that
and lots of offline requirement in the physical security case.
Absolutely, yeah. And by the end of this calendar year, we will have sort of deployed customers that are literally doing exactly what that directive says, which is using their PKI smart cards for both physical and IT security. And not only that, but using the same management systems to control them. So you'll be able to, you know, pull up your, you know, your Active Directory console for setting your, you know, IT privileges for users, and right there there'll be a tab for, you know, setting which doors they can go through, and you just do it all in one place.
Yeah. And what's the status of? I remember one of the most fascinating things about that scenario, as you described it to me, was the notion that information can jump from card to card through the agency of, let's say, the door lock, all the while the door lock being offline, right?
Yeah.
So you have a kind of a sneaker net effect going.
Right.
That's
the core. So we're calling that architecture now card connected.
Okay.
And that's that is an inherent part of all of our physical security products. So we actually do have companies now that are building physical locks, even as small as interchangeable cylinders. But yeah, the idea of having our proofs, you know, just like you can, since they're so distributable, you know, just like you can put them to a cache server on Akamai or a non-secure responder physically sitting in your wiring closet, well, you can take them one step further, getting them closer to the user and actually putting them on your actual card and, you know, having the offline locks be responsible for updating them. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like few people are ready to go the other half of that, which is to do the management piece that actually figures out what is going to be attribute controlled and pushes that stuff out, right? I mean, it's at least that's my impression, right? People are still kind of debating, like, how to do that.
Yeah, people are debating, but the customers are ready for it, and you know, the simple solutions for it are going to start getting some traction, I think.
Right. Right.
So, you know, we'll have, you know, right now in our work with Honeywell, you know, if you're using the Honeywell, you know, NextWatch software, which is what you're using now to control attributes and access for physical security, now you could just use that same software, and now it works with, you know, disconnected doors as well. In a few months, we'll have our Active Directory integration ready. So if you're using, you know, Microsoft products, which most companies are, to manage your IT resources, then you'll just have a new tab exactly in the same way that you specify, you know, what kind of directories and file permissions you have by group. You know, you'll have a new tab that specifies, you know, doors and access times and things like that. So, you know, that stuff is not, it's not really as hard as people make it out to be, and we'll have, you know, real working products that, that demonstrate this. I think they'll get some good traction.
Yeah, I think it's just conceptually hard for people to decide where to make the cut between what is managed in a central directory based on an authentication of a person and what is actually pushed out.
Well, the way that we make that distinction is we think about, you know, the authentication versus validation, right? So authentication, right, is just managing just who you are.
Exactly. And it just, it's kind of simpler and cleaner to think about it in those terms,
yeah,
at least
initially.
I think
that's the only way that makes sense. And we really see it as, and yeah, you can be metaphysical about this, right? And you can say, well, you know, which of my attributes are really fixed and which are, you know, which are malleable? And if you say, well, the fixed ones are your identity and the malleable ones are your privileges. So for example, you know, my name and my, you know, social security number, and that kind of stuff doesn't really change when I lose my job or you know, get access to a new set of doors, then, well, that the former stuff is my identity and the latter stuff are my privileges. And that's kind of the approach we've taken. I mean, you can quibble with that and you can say, well, what happens if you change your name or, you know, what happens if you change your gender or what happens if, you know, aliens come and alter your DNA or something. And so, yeah, there's kind of a slippery slope there, but for all practical purposes, you can really segregate, you know, the stuff about you that doesn't change and call that identity and authentication. And the purpose of your smart card and your digital certificate and then your biometrics should be to authenticate you, to establish who you are. And
yes.
Everything else is privileges. And the nice thing about that split is you can have one master record for authentication, and you can have multiple overlapping, non-cooperative records for privileges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have different organizations responsible for setting privileges that they care about for their employees. So, you know, if you've got a... you know, the original example that we used with this TWIC card, right, this transportation workers card, which is now going to be part of FIPS 201, is, you know, every single transportation worker, whether they're, you know, a federal air marshal or a, you know, Starbucks employee at the Logan Airport, you know, is going to have one of these cards. And so the Department of Homeland Security is responsible for the authentication. But then if, you know, American Airlines wants to say, okay, for our pilots, we're going to designate privileges and say you're an American Airlines pilot. And if, you know, Starbucks Corporation wants to say, well, for our airport employees, we're going to have this privilege for, you know, who are Starbucks employees. Well, you know, Starbucks Corporation does not have to acknowledge the existence of American Airlines and vice versa in order for this to work. You know, they're just both putting out privileges that are associated with the same master authentication record.
Right. But all of that can be handled in the door or in the server or wherever it is that's doing the checking.
Right.
And, you know, as we've seen, that can be distributed and, you know, those processes can occur even offline. So that being the case, what is the actual need to push stuff out onto the card to have actual encoded attributes on the card that are themselves representing privileges? Maybe there's really not much of a need to do that, right?
Well, we just see that as, you know, we see the card as just a temporary part of the network.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, kind of when you look at a card, the common way to think about this is that, okay, that card is just your credential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it shows who you are. We kind of think about the card having two pieces. There's the piece that's your credential, and that very specifically is the PKI piece,
mm-hmm.
right? That's your credential. But the card also happens to have, you know, half of the card is your network.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a temporary scratch pad for your network. And so it's just, you know, it's just an opportunistic place where you can put some stuff that, you know, you can also get if you were to plug into an Ethernet line or something. It's
right.
It's just a cache.
Right.
You know, so then if you think about it that way, it's not really a question of what privileges are you putting on the card. You don't think about it like that. You think about what privileges exist on the network.
Yeah.
And some of those may at some point in time be written on the scratch area of the card as, you know, as a part of the network.
Yeah, that's really helpful because I think maybe another deterrent there is if you start to think about putting attributes onto the card, then you might wonder about, well, I run out of space.
Yeah.
What happens then, right?
Sure.
And this is a more fluid way
it's
to,
just,
to
right.
deal
it's
with
just
it.
It's just literally, you know, it's part of the sneaker net.
Yeah.
You know, and the sneaker net is part of the overall network. And,
yeah.
You know, it always has been. We're just sort of officially saying that this is another place on the network that you can transmit things.
Thanks, Phil. Clearly, this idea of unifying physical and virtual security is still very much a leading edge kind of thing. But it's obviously where things are headed, and I really enjoy Phil's perspectives on the subject.